It's a fine day, and you've decided to get some fresh air and exercise. You're out and about, moving with vitality, and comfortably unaware of the moments that come and go in the pleasant procession of time. But something is about to happen that will shatter your serenity and make this otherwise disposable moment suddenly unforgettable. You see, you are about to fall victim to a traumatic accident, a compound fracture of your leg. Your eyes will widen with shock as you see the sharp, white protrusion of bone where it should not be. And as the pain crescendos, all you will want is to reach out and grab this moment and hold it once again. This moment when you were healthy, when you moved with vitality, when the horrible accident had not yet happened. For almost all people who have ever lived prior to the modern age, they would think much the same. If only they could somehow undo what happened, reach back in time and re-grasp their health. But for them, such an injury would be catastrophically irreversible. Until little over a century ago, a compound fracture could rarely be fixed, and the true terror of their experience would not be the pain, but the realization that it was probably the beginning of their end. Their next moment would commence an agonizing countdown to a likely death by infection, disrupted only by the vain attempt at amputation without anesthesia. For you, though, it would be quite different. Your next moment would feature a rapid response of aseptic surgical care under general anesthesia, through which you'd experience relatively minor pain. Recovery would be arduous, but you would recover, and you would almost certainly regain your vitality. In the eyes of all who lived before the modern age of surgery, you would have the power to reach through time and grasp that precious moment of health before the accident. From correcting compound fractures to replacing failed organs, modern surgery has heavily armed us against the historical scourge of untimely morbidity and mortality. But how have we gained such mastery over our anatomy to heal ourselves like mutant superheroes in comparison to the suffering of our ancestors? How did we conquer pain and infection? How did we go from applying leeches to fastening ligatures, from bloodletting to bone marrow grafting? I give you surgery and how it began. A tearful young woman sits with her children, several elders, and a healer in the largest home of her village near the shore of the Caspian Sea, just north of modern-day Iran. She has just had most of the hair removed from her scalp. Shimmering brown and beautiful, it lays in a silken semicircle on the ground around her. Her companions are doing their best to soothe and comfort, but she's more afraid of what's coming next. To dull her apprehension and the excruciating pain to come, they've given her a powerfully intoxicating tea. And as she swallows the last puddle in her cup, her weepiness slackens. Her children are asked to leave now. They kiss her hands and go outside. A few of the elders take positions to immobilize the woman's languid body as the healer draws forth a razor-sharp flint. To steady his hands, the healer takes a sip of the intoxicant himself. One more deep breath, and he brings his ancient scalpel stone to the top of the woman's bare head. He works as rapidly as he can, and his flint is so sharp that the woman can barely feel the initial incisions through her inebriation. But once the man peels back the skin and begins to score her skull, the immobilizers struggle to keep her still. Back and forth in a square-like pattern, he methodically thins the perimeter of a walnut-sized segment of bone until it's completely detached and floats on the fluid beneath. He removes it and replaces the skin, suturing it carefully back into place with a bone needle and intestinal thread. The woman, who has remained conscious throughout the procedure thus far, begins to pass out from a heady mix of pain, exhaustion, and relief. She is laid down carefully to rest amid a plush pad of furs. The healer leads the accompanying elders through prayer. With the blessing of the gods, the woman's debilitating demonic possession will finally be freed through the hole they've just bored into her skull. Modern archaeologists will unearth this woman's remains 12,000 years later, and they will recognize obvious signs of bone healing and aging beyond the time of her Stone Age brain surgery. She survived the procedure. Whatever her symptoms actually were that might have motivated such radical intervention, migraines, seizures, or otherwise, remain mysterious, and so too does the extent to which the ordeal provided her with relief. But this type of surgery, called trepanation, a gruesome exercise of drilling or cutting a hole in the skull, was practiced with shocking regularity throughout Eurasia as far back as the agricultural revolution 12,000 years ago. Hundreds of trepanned skulls have been found among Stone Age burial sites, making this, of all things, the earliest widespread surgery on record. It is undoubtedly the case that other less invasive surgeries were regularly performed on softer anatomy even further back in history, but bones weather the passage of time in a way that flesh does not, and so skull trepanation marks the first conspicuous surgery for which we have direct evidence. Over the next 10,000 years, however, most surgery remained superficial and minor. Major intervention, such as amputation or any kind of abdominal incision, was rare for two principal reasons. It reliably killed the patient through infection or blood loss, and, of course, it was intolerably agonizing without modern anesthetics. On the other hand, flesh wounds, abscesses, varicose veins, and even small tumors and cataracts were regularly treated with some success. From ancient Egypt on the Mediterranean and Babylon in modern-day Iraq to Rishikesh in northern India, ancient surgeons working in the world's richest civilizations established increasingly reliable methods of relief for numerous common ailments by way of cutting and perforating the body. And as usual, some of the best written records we have come from the Greeks, who not only spent centuries fine-tuning minor surgical techniques, but who also sought a theoretical understanding of human anatomy and physiology. The most influential Greek surgeon was a man named Galen, born around the year 130 AD. In addition to performing minor operations on his human patients, Galen dissected animals, mostly pigs and monkeys. Although this helped reveal the basic structure and function of bones and muscles and nerves, it led Galen to make literally hundreds of inaccurate conclusions about human anatomy. He completely misinterpreted cardiovascular structure and function, for example. Nonetheless, in the context of Western civilization's subsequent entrenchment of religiously repressive sensibilities, Galen's teachings completely dominated Europeans' understanding of the human body for over 1,300 years. That is, until an audacious medical student decided to break the law. Midnight, Paris, France, 1536 AD. A 22-year-old medical student named Andreas Vesalius feels his heart pounding in his own chest as he slices into the dead chest of another. The metal of his neatly laid out knives reflects the flickering candle flame of the room. He is alone, but for the corpse on the table before him, with which he's just returned breathlessly from the nearby gallows. The cadaver was a living criminal only hours before, so Vesalius can work without being completely overwhelmed by the stench of putrefaction. Piece by piece, layer by layer, this dauntless young medical student is proceeding to do something both illegal and unprecedented. He is personally dissecting a human body. It's not that Vesalius had never seen dissection performed. It had been, after all, carried out from time to time at his medical school at the University of Paris for centuries. But dissections were relatively rare in those days, and even when they did occur, students and faculty sat afar from the body and merely looked on as well as they could while a servant undertook a set of unsteady incisions dictated to him by the medical director. The point of such performances was simply to inculcate in yet another class of medical students the long unquestioned teachings of Galen. Vesalius and his peers were pressured to see what they were taught to believe about human anatomy, rather than believe whatever they might see for themselves. The spectacle did more to frustrate Vesalius than anything else, and he had grown determined to get his hands on his own cadaver, even though local law and Catholic convention prohibited it. After that first thrilling night in 1536, when Vesalius sliced open his first body and saw for himself just how different human anatomy was from how Europeans had been instructed since antiquity, he was hooked. Over the course of the next 7 years, he regularly absconded with bodies in the night, dug up from graves or cut down from gallows, in order to produce a true blueprint of the human machine and compile it in his masterpiece, the first new textbook on human anatomy in Europe in over 1,000 years. Published in 1543, Vesalius's work, titled On the Fabric of the Human Body, completely revolutionized all of Western medicine, enabling surgeons to know what was really beneath their knives for the first time. In the generations that followed Vesalius's publication, Europe became the most violent continent in the world. Religious wars fueled by a devastating new technology, guns, were slaughtering millions. Bullets were dramatically more destructive to human tissue than almost anything that had been caused by blades. And the near constant total war across Central Europe drew hundreds of surgeons to the front lines, where they encountered the unprecedented scope of blood loss and deep tissue infection caused by musket balls and cannon. Initially suspecting that gunpowder residue on ballistics must be poisonous to cause such damage, battlefield surgeons resorted to pouring boiling hot oil into soldiers' wounds in hopes that it would both destroy the poison and cauterize the tissue to staunch blood loss. But the brutal practice caused more suffering than it was worth, further damaging tissues and inducing so much pain that men reliably went into neurogenic shock, which could itself be deadly. Day in, day out, watching their patients writhe in agony as superheated oil bubbled over their exposed flesh, surgeons increasingly hesitated to apply the treatment, only to watch terrified young soldiers before them bleed out. Growing desperate to discover an alternative, one military surgeon named Amboise Perret eventually tried to just tie off the spurting artery in one of his patients with a short bit of twine at hand. It worked. The usual languorous slide into cold unconsciousness never happened, and his patient remained alive, at least long enough to be removed from the field. A milestone in the history of surgery, clamping and tying off arteries to stop catastrophic blood loss, called ligation, began to save thousands of lives on the battlefield in the mid-1500s, and spread into common practice soon after. Still, as quickly as Vesalius's and Paré's work followed upon each other in the mid-1500s, their example did not stimulate further waves of advancement for several centuries. And in the meantime, major surgery remained nearly as brutal and life-threatening an ordeal as it had always been. By 1800, many surgeons had mastered human anatomy and could prevent a patient from bleeding out on the table. But the horrible pain of conscious cutting and a high mortality rate continued to plague the practice. Anything beyond minor surgery was still mortally terrifying for most people. Amputation was the most common major surgery, and nearly half of all people who suffered the experience, generally while restrained and clenching wood or leather between their molars through the pain, ended up dying from the mysterious bane of infection a few weeks later anyway. Crude analgesics like alcohol and opiates weren't even close to being truly effective. And if a patient was fearful enough to drink himself unconscious, most surgeons declined to operate, since complications like increased blood loss would just kill him faster. The best that surgeons could do was focus their training on operating rapidly to minimize the duration of a patient's suffering. They would practice their techniques over and over with watches in hand before doing it live. Indeed, it was the quickest surgeons who earned the best reputations, becoming both highly sought after and highly paid. The faster their hands, the more likely they were to receive teaching appointments and even royal patronage. But this was a symptom of stagnation, not progress. Hundreds of years after Vesalius's and Paré's revelations, surgery still seemed stuck in the Dark Ages, especially compared to the contemporary blossoming of modern science and economics through the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. But then, in the fall of 1846, a surgeon from Boston was reading his morning paper, and he happened to come across a report about a local dentist who had succeeded in pulling a tooth painlessly with ether. The dentist, William Morton, was promptly invited to demonstrate his new anesthesia at the Massachusetts General Hospital Surgical Arena. As an auditorium of onlookers held their breath in anticipation, a patient suffering from a neck tumor filled his own lungs with Morton's citrus-scented ether. A few moments later, when his body grew limp and his eyes rolled, Morton looked up at the attending surgeon. "Your patient is ready," he declared. The surgeon, Dr. John Collins Warren, then proceeded to drag his scalpel 3 inches across the man's neck and excise the cancerous gland. Only when Warren was securing his last suture to complete the operation several minutes later did the groggy patient begin to stir.
How did that feel?
Asked Warren once the man finally came to.
I thought I felt someone scratching at my neck, the man is reported to have said.
At this, Warren knew he had witnessed something that would transform his profession. He turned to address the onlooking crowd and said,
Gentlemen, we have seen something today that will go round the whole world.
And it did. Newspapers and medical journals were soaked with ink dedicated to the story, and thousands of impetuous surgeons raced to procure whatever ether they could to try the magic firsthand. Unfortunately, many of them obtained impure mixtures that either failed to sufficiently subdue their patients or produced terrible respiratory irritation and vomiting. Yet, the magnificent promise of general anesthesia had been proven, and so while the majority of surgeons sought to make the best of it with ether, others became motivated to test related chemicals. Within a year, chloroform emerged as a safer and more effective substitute. And after Queen Victoria of England herself opted for chloroform anesthesia while giving birth to Prince Leopold in 1853, it became mainstream. Within a single decade, a 10,000-year-old tradition of agony had evaporated. But anesthesia did more than liberate humanity from the physical anguish of operations. It also unshackled surgeons from the constraints of working as quickly as possible. Rather than writhing, unconscious patients now remained still, and surgeons could actually take their time and focus on the quality of their maneuvers. The precision of surgery improved remarkably. The biggest obstacle, though, still haunted humanity. Infection. Surgery might have been rendered painless, but it was far from safe. Through the 1860s, people avoided hospitals as assiduously as they might avoid abattoirs and garbage dumps. The prevailing belief was that smells of decay carried the agent of infection. Not only that, but until the end of the 1800s, hospitals functioned largely as asylums for the destitute, who were assumed to spread fleas and lice. Nurses' caps, the icon of medical stewardship, were worn not to protect the patient, but to protect the nurse from the patient's lice-ridden hair. Anyone who could afford it paid for the surgeon to come to their home. But even when performed in the cleanest private bedrooms and kitchens, major surgery killed upwards of 50% of everyone compelled to undergo the knife. Throughout Western civilization, the plague of postoperative infection drove doctors mad. Dozens devoted their prime professional years not to operating, but to the epidemiological work of experimenting with protocols that might shield their patients from the invisible killer. They tried everything, from dousing wounds in freezing water to erecting barriers of fire at every building entrance. Good ventilation to air out the presumed miasma of decay was considered fundamental to sanitation, but keen observers realized that even this proved to have little effect. Once again, it would take a breakthrough from outside of the surgical profession to inspire its practitioners and help bridge the final gap to modern surgery through disinfection. For years, a Scottish surgeon named Joseph Lister had struggled through his own unsuccessful attempts to control infection. But in addition to testing techniques firsthand, he also read voraciously about the work of other researchers in other fields. In 1865, he encountered a paper published by a French chemist named Louis Pasteur, who showed that microorganisms, which had been known about for centuries and which everyone assumed were benign, were actually responsible for fermentation and even the rotting of food. Sometime soon after reading the report, when Lister's colleague commented on the sewage-like smell emanating from a gangrenous wound, Lister's mind sparked with the connection. Germs. Pasteur's germs caused infection. To kill them, Lister would try the most obvious chemical he knew, the same chemical that the city was using to deodorize municipal sewage, carbolic acid. The occasion for the much-anticipated experiment arrived in August that year, when a 7-year-old boy was wheeled into Lister's clinic suffering a sharp, white protrusion of bone in his leg. The boy's parents were motivated to bring him in by the instinctual hope that someone might somehow undo the catastrophe of his compound fracture. But even as Lister anesthetized him and reset the boy's bones, his parents numbly prepared for the ancient fate that too often followed traditional major surgery: pus, fever, and death. They never imagined that their son would be the very first patient of modern surgery, that his wounds would be dressed in carbolic acid-soaked bandages so that no infection, therefore, could take root, and that they would see him healthy and running again within only 2 months. Lister's experiment worked like an answer to their prayers. Nearly 330 years had passed since Andreas Vesalius had stolen his first corpse and opened the way for surgeons to become the ultimate healers. And now, Joseph Lister's antiseptic breakthrough in 1865 would combine with ligation and anesthesia to finally make major surgery both tolerable and safe forever. As the world sped into the 20th century, a flood of ancillary technologies complemented modern surgery. First and foremost, electricity illuminated operations, replacing the whimsy of daylight and the din of gas-powered flames with dazzling arrays of light bulbs whose brightness could be aimed directly at the anatomy of concern. Electricity also powered countless new tools of diagnosis, operation, and monitoring. X-rays, suction siphons, and heart monitors were soon integrated into the standard protocol of care, as the physical venue of operation itself metamorphosized from a place of wood, leather, and cast iron before the First World War into a sterile technological ecosystem of glass, rubber, and stainless steel after it. By mid-century, powerful systemic antibiotics like penicillin only enhanced our dominance over common infection. And by the year 2000, plastics, robotics, lasers, and computers had all been rallied to the cause of cutting to heal, building upon the pillars of modern surgery that its practitioners had managed to lay in an era when the world was still illuminated by fire. 150 years have passed since Joseph Lister applied the first antiseptic bandages to help a 7-year-old patient defy his ancient fate and re-grasp his vitality. Today, surgery has become so safe and effective that the average American will undergo more than 9 operations, of which half are likely to be elective. We have transcended merely regaining our natural vitality. Now, we strive to surgically enhance it. If you enjoy this podcast, please help me spread the word. You can leave reviews on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you happen to listen. You can share it on Facebook and Twitter. You can discuss it on your own podcast or blog. And of course, you can personally tell your family and friends about it. A lot of people are still unfamiliar with podcasts, and maybe you could help them get started with How It Began. For more information on this episode, including a select bibliography, visit howitbegan.com. I'm Brad Harris. So long.